KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
If they're not back by the time I get into office, all hell will break out in the Middle East. And it will not be good for Hamas, and it will not be good, frankly, for anyone.
As Trump holds a news conference at Mar-a-Lago for more than an hour, we'll get response from Massachusetts Democratic Congressmember Jim McGovern. He's also calling for President Biden to posthumously exonerate Ethel Rosenberg, who, along with her husband, Julius Rosenberg, was executed for sharing nuclear secrets with the Soviet Union. We'll also speak with one of the Rosenberg sons, Robert Mirapol, who's citing a newly released classified document showing the National Security Agency knew Ethel Rosenberg was not a spy and that the government executed her anyway. We'll also speak with McGovern about calls for Biden to pardon human rights lawyer Stephen Donziger. Then, after nearly a decade in power, the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is stepping down.
I intend to resign as party leader, as Prime Minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process.
We'll speak with longtime Canadian activist Avi Lewis, who's now running for office in Vancouver. And after more than 20 years of being imprisoned without charge under the so-called war on terror, the Pentagon's transferred 11 men from Yemen out of Guantanamo to Oman to restart their lives. We'll speak with two lawyers whose clients are among those released this week. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli strikes have killed at least another 51 people in Gaza as the official death toll nears 46,000, though it's believed to be a vast undercount. Earlier this morning, a 15-day-old baby was killed in an Israeli airstrike in Gaza City. At least five displaced Palestinian children were also killed in Israeli strikes on tents in Almawasi, which had been designated as safe zone by Israel. Families in Gaza are building grave-like pits below their tents to protect children from the relentless strikes. This is Tassir Obeid, whose family is sheltering in Deir al-Balah after they were displaced nine times by Israel's forced evacuation orders.
The tent, given that it has a pit with high walls surrounding it, protects my children from random strikes. My children, how were they in the past, and how are they in the present? They were dignified. We, thank God, were in our homes and lands with our dignity, let's say. Currently, we live underground, as if in a grave. Surely this is not easy.
In the occupied West Bank town of Tamun, an Israeli drone strike has killed three Palestinians, including two boys, 8-year-old Reda Ali Ahmed Basharat and 10-year-old Hamza Amma Ahmed Basharat. Israeli forces have also detained 45 Palestinians in the West Bank as part of a sweeping crackdown after Palestinian gunmen killed three Israelis on Monday. Israel's far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, responded to Monday's attack by calling for cities in the West Bank to, quote, be turned into another Jabalia, a reference to the destroyed refugee camp in Gaza. Israeli settlers have also attacked several West Bank towns, burning cars, ransacking homes, and setting crops on fire. The Palestinian news outlet Wafa reported Israeli troops fired at Palestinians in the village of Amaten as they tried to confront violent settlers. Ireland's become the latest country to formally join South Africa's genocide case against Israel before the International Court of Justice. Last month, Israel closed its embassy in Ireland to protest after Ireland initially said it would join the case. Meanwhile, Israel's blocking the United Nations from investigating reports of sexual crimes committed by Hamas during the October 7th attack. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz reports Israel blocked the probe because it feared it would open the door to the UN investigating the sexual abuse of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons. The Biden administration's announced new sanctions against Sudan's rapid support forces after concluding the paramilitary group committed genocide. Secretary of State Tony Blinken said Tuesday he'd made the determination, quote, after reviewing the horrifying information of suffering inside Sudan, where more than half the population, some 25.6 million people, has faced crisis-level hunger over the past year. The UN says more than 150,000 people have been killed since fighting erupted in April 2023. 11 million have fled their homes. The New York Times reports the Biden administration had been reluctant to admit the rapid support forces were committing genocide in Sudan for fear it would highlight Biden's refusal to make the same determination about Israel's killing of Palestinians in Gaza. President-elect Trump has renewed his threat to respond with violence if Hamas does not release hostages held in Gaza.
If they're not back by the time I get into office, all hell will break out in the Middle East.
Can you elaborate?
And it will not be good for Hamas, and it will not be good, frankly, for anyone.
Trump made the remarks during a wide-ranging, rambling news conference at Mar-a-Lago Tuesday, in which Trump repeatedly lied, aired grievances about the many legal cases against him, and threatened to use the Pentagon to expand U.S. territory. In an extraordinary exchange, Trump refused to rule out military action to take control of Greenland and the Panama Canal.
We need them for economic security. The Panama Canal was built for our military. I'm not going to commit to that now. It might be that you'll have to do something.
Trump threatened to use economic force to absorb Canada into the United States. He continued his push later in the day on social media, posting maps showing Canada as part of the U.S. In reply, Canada's outgoing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau responded, there's not a, quote, snowball's chance in hell the two countries would merge. Trump also hinted at pardons over the January 6th insurrection, repeating the lie that none of the rioters carried guns into the Capitol. And Trump proposed changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America as he continued his attacks on immigrants. We'll have more on Trump after headlines with Congressmember Jim McGovern. Pope Francis has appointed an outspoken Trump critical critic, liberal cardinal Robert McElroy, as the next Archbishop of Washington, D.C., just 2 weeks ahead of Trump's inauguration. Cardinal McElroy has condemned Trump's anti-immigrant positions, including his vow to carry out mass deportations. McElroy has also called for the Catholic Church to be more welcoming to LGBTQ members. Meanwhile, Trump has tapped Brian Birch, the leader of the right-wing Catholic advocacy group Catholic Vote, to be U.S. ambassador to the Vatican. The House of Representatives has approved the first bill of the 119th Congress, legislation that would require federal immigration authorities to detain undocumented immigrants arrested for certain nonviolent crimes. 48 Democrats sided with Republicans Tuesday, voting in favor of the Laken Riley Act, named after a 22-year-old nursing student who was killed by a Venezuelan immigrant last year. Rights groups have condemned the legislation. The Haitian Bridge Alliance called it a devastating blow to human rights and the core values of compassion and asylum, adding, quote, this cruel legislation targets vulnerable migrants and asylum seekers, denying them safety and dignity. Los Angeles is under a state of emergency after three fast-moving wildfires exploded in size Tuesday, prompting evacuations affecting some 30,000 people. Over 1,400 firefighters are battling the massive fires in L.A.'s Pacific Palisades neighborhood, north of San Fernando, and in Altadena. Forecasters are warning of near-perfect fire conditions today, with wind gusts nearing 100 miles per hour. Much of the region has not seen significant rainfall in over 8 months. Last summer was among Southern California's hottest on record. Meanwhile, a major winter storm brought snowy and icy conditions to the Midwest and Mid-Atlantic, with at least 7 deaths blamed on the storms. Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg has announced an end to fact-checking initiatives on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Zuckerberg announced the change in a video posted online Tuesday.
After Trump first got elected in 2016, the legacy media wrote nonstop about how misinformation was a threat to democracy. We tried in good faith to address those concerns without becoming the arbiters of truth. But the fact checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the U.S.
Nicole Gill, the head of Accountable Tech, called Meta's move a, quote, gift to Donald Trump and extremists around the world. Wired reports Meta has also loosened its policies on what can be posted on its platforms. Wired reports Meta users will now be allowed to say gay and trans people have mental illness. CNN reports Facebook will also permit users to call women, quote, household objects. Meanwhile, Meta has appointed a close Trump ally, Dana White, to the company's board. White is the CEO of Ultimate Fighting Championship. The Washington Post announced Tuesday it'll lay off 4% of its workforce, or nearly 100 people. The layoffs come just weeks after the Post's billionaire owner, Jeff Bezos, blocked an endorsement to Vice President Kamala Harris ahead in the November election. By the Washington Post's own count, Bezos' decision prompted 250,000 readers to cancel their subscriptions in protest. The Biden administration's approved new rules that would wipe out an estimated $49 billion in unpaid medical bills from the credit reports of roughly 15 million people. The rules were finalized Tuesday by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, an agency that billionaire Trump mega donor Elon Musk has said he hopes to delete after Trump installs him as co-leader of the new Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. And members of Congress, Supreme Court justices, and other dignitaries gathered at the U.S. Capitol Tuesday for a lying in state ceremony for former President Jimmy Carter. Vice President Kamala Harris delivered a eulogy.
He was a president who, between the years of 1977 and 1981, appointed more Black Americans to the federal bench than all of his predecessors combined, and appointed five times as many women.
President Carter will be buried following a state funeral at the Washington National Cathedral on Thursday and a private funeral at home in Georgia. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, President-elect Donald Trump held his second news conference since winning the 2024 election, addressing a wide range of topics over more than an hour. Speaking at Mar-a-Lago to reporters, Trump renewed his threat to respond with violence if Hamas does not release hostages held in Gaza by inauguration.
If they're not back by the time I get into office, all hell will break out in the Middle East.
Can you elaborate?
And it will not be good for Hamas. And it will not be good, frankly, for anyone.
Trump also aired grievances about the many legal cases against him and threatened to use the military to expand U.S. territory. In an extraordinary exchange, Trump refused to rule out military action to take control of Greenland and the Panama Canal.
You're talking about Panama and Greenland. No, I can't assure you on either of those two. But I can say this. We need them for economic security. The Panama Canal was built for our military. I'm not going to commit to that now. It might be that you'll have to do something. Look, the Panama Canal is vital to our country. It's being operated by China. China. And we gave the Panama Canal to Panama. We didn't give it to China. And they've abused it. They've abused that gift. It should have never been made, by the way. Giving the Panama Canal is why Jimmy Carter lost the election, in my opinion, more so maybe than the hostages. The hostages were a big deal. But if you remember, and nobody wants to talk about the Panama Canal now because, you know, it's inappropriate, I guess, but because it's a bad part of the Carter legacy. But he was a good man. Look, he was a good man. I knew him a little bit, and he was a very fine person. But that was a big mistake. Giving the Panama Canal to Panama was a very big mistake.
Trump threatened to use economic force to absorb Canada into the United States. He continued his push later in the day on social media, posting maps showing Canada part of the United States. In response, Canada's outgoing Prime Minister Justin Trudeau responded, "There's not a snowball's chance in hell the two countries will merge." Trump also proposed changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America as he continued his attacks on immigrants. And he also hinted at pardons over the January 6th insurrection, repeating the lie that none of the rioters carried guns into the Capitol, arguing instead that Hezbollah played a role in January 6th.
We have to find out about Hezbollah. We have to find out about who exactly was in that whole thing, because people that did some bad things were not prosecuted. You know, I see it all the time, and you see it too. People that were doing some bad things weren't prosecuted, and people that didn't even walk into the building are in jail right now.
To discuss Trump's Tuesday press conference and much more, we're joined by Democratic Congressmember Jim McGovern in the Cannon Rotunda in the House office building, not far from the Capitol Rotunda, where President Carter is lying in state. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Congressmember McGovern. If you can start off by responding to this meandering press conference yesterday, where lie after lie was uttered by the president-elect.
Well, look, Donald Trump says dumb things every day of his life. He lies hourly, and that's just who he is. But you know, I think he does it to try to distract us, to try to divert our attention away from focusing in on the things that he promised to do, like lowering the price of groceries, lowering the cost of gasoline, straightening out the entire world before he takes office. But, you know, he has us going in a million different directions, and I think it's intentional. And again, I thought what he said yesterday was dumb, but it's nothing new. It's what we hear from him every single day.
Well, the question is it just dumb and it can be ignored? He's just maybe trying to take away attention from the dead former president, which was, you know, getting so much attention as his body was brought to the Capitol Rotunda. And this bipartisan group of senators and Congress members, supporters, the whole family of Carter was getting so much attention over these 4 days. And also, he might be very aggravated that President Biden has called for all flags at half staff for 30 days, which will go through the inauguration. Right. He's commented on that. Or should we take this very seriously? He's talking about possible military action to take Greenland. His son, Donald Trump Jr., was in Greenland yesterday, and to take back the Panama Canal, which Carter gave back to Panama.
Yeah. Well, there's no question he craves attention constantly. But the fact of the matter is, again, I mean, the outrageous things that he said yesterday, you know, are nothing new. I mean, this is what he has done, you know, time and time again, all throughout the campaign. But the bottom line is, you know, what I'm worried about is my constituency, are the people of this country. You know, I head up the Hunger Caucus here in the United States House of Representatives. We have 40 million Americans. 40 million Americans who live in this country, the richest country in the history of the world, who are hungry, who are food insecure. You know, I want to do something about that. And quite frankly, what I'm worried about is what he and the Republicans want to do in terms of cutting programs that actually can help feed people in this country. So, you know, he talks about, you know, invading Greenland and making Canada part of our country. And he goes on and on and on. And it's all outrageous and it is all ridiculous. But meanwhile, there are people in this country right now who are struggling, people who are in poverty, people who are in the middle class, people who are hoping that maybe government can actually do something to make their lives better. And he's talking about all this other stuff. So, yeah, we can spend hours and hours and hours and hours talking about all the stuff that he talked about yesterday. Again, it's outrageous. I mean, can't believe that this person is going to enter the Oval Office again. But the fact of the matter is, you know, we can't lose our focus on the American people.
And your response to Meta, this news just coming out yesterday, you have President Trump threatening to put Zuckerberg in jail, the CEO of Meta. Then Zuckerberg goes to Mar-a-Lago. When Trump was asked yesterday at the news conference if he's forcing the changes at Meta, I mean, Zuckerberg astonishingly said they're not going to have fact checkers anymore. Yeah. Trump said, yes, it's my pressure that has changed Zuckerberg and has put Dana White, his wrestling buddy, onto the board of Meta.
Well, shame on Zuckerberg. Shame on all these billionaires who are, you know, going to see Trump on bended knee. I mean, all they're interested in is making more money. But the bottom line is, you know, what Mark Zuckerberg is doing is basically paving the way to undermine our democracy. I mean, to be able to, you know, I heard you, your opening about the not now the ability to be able to refer to women in derogatory terms, to be able to, you know, bash the LGBTQ plus community, to say them, to say things that are just wrong, to promote conspiracy theories, and there's no checks or balances. You know, that's not free speech. In fact, that's an abuse of free speech. That's about undermining our democracy, and that's something we do have to worry about. Look, I've said over and over and over again, you know, that you know, Donald Trump is leading a movement to promote authoritarianism. You know, people who studied history, you know, wondered how did fascism rise in Europe during before World War II. We now know. We see what's happening in this country, and quite frankly, it's outrageous, and we all should be concerned about that.
Let me ask you about Gaza. In the final days of the Biden administration, the president has reportedly notified Congress of a new $8 billion arms sale to Israel. The deal includes artillery shells, small diameter bombs, warheads, munitions for fighter jets, helicopter gunships. In approving the sale, Biden once again rejected calls to suspend U.S. support for Israel's military over war crimes Israel's committed in Gaza. Now, you were part of a group of Congress members, including Congressmember Pocan, Lee, Castro, McCollum, who are urging the Biden administration to abide by the Leahy Law, named for the retired Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, about respecting human rights or not continuing the arms flow. Your response to this latest move, there are now tens of billions of dollars the U.S. has given to Israel since October 23rd.
Yeah.
It's
terribly disappointing. And it's not just the Leahy Law. We have another law, by the way, that says that if a country frustrates the delivery of humanitarian aid to people who are in need, then all military assistance to that country gets suspended. So we have urged the president to follow the U.S. laws. They are on the books, and he's not following them. You know, you mentioned at the top of your show that Donald Trump said if all the hostages aren't released by Inauguration Day, all hell will break loose. Well, I want all the hostages released. I've been calling for that over and over and over again. But, I mean, all hell has already broke loose. I mean, if what's happening in Gaza is not hell right now, I don't know what is. You know, and it's not just Gaza. It's what's happening on the West Bank. So, I wish the president weren't doing this. I wish he were, you know, standing firm and defending U.S. law and sending a message to Netanyahu that, yeah, we support the people of Israel, but we do not support what he is doing to the Palestinian people. It is outrageous. It is unconscionable. And again, I'm very disappointed with that announcement.
We're talking with Massachusetts Congressmember Jim McGovern, who's also part of a last-ditch appeal for President Biden to posthumously exonerate Ethel Rosenberg, who, along with her husband Julius Rosenberg, was charged with sharing nuclear secrets, conspiring to give them to the Soviet Union. They were executed June 19, 1953. FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover accused the couple of committing the crime of the century. This is a clip of the newscast after the Rosenberg's execution.
Someone had passed America's atomic bomb secrets to Russia. This was an undisputed fact that the whole world knew. The federal government had laid the crime at the doorstep of two native New Yorkers, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. But to the end, they both protested their innocence of the theft. In April of 1951, the federal court of Judge Irving R. Kaufman found the pair guilty as charged and sentenced them to death in the electric chair to pay for their crime of treason.
But Congressmember McGovern and others are citing a newly released classified document that shows the National Security Agency knew Ethel Rosenberg was not a spy and that the government executed her anyway. Congressmember Jim McGovern is with us now to discuss this, along with Robert Mirapol, the younger son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. He was 6 years old at the time of their execution. He's author of the autobiography An Execution in the Family, One Son's Journey. He's also founder and executive director of the Rosenberg Fund for Children. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Robert in this call for the exoneration of your mother, Ethel.
Thank you for having me, Amy.
So really explain exactly what this memo shows and how important this is to you.
Well, my brother and I, and with now the help of the Rosenberg Fund for Children, which is run by my daughter, Jennifer Mirapol, we have been trying for 50 years using the Freedom of Information Act to get the government's own material out. And we've collected bits and pieces along the way. And we've shown that the only evidence against Ethel presented at trial was perjured testimony. We've shown that prosecutorial documents illustrate that even the government said the case against Ethel was weak. And when the Soviet code was broken and the materials were released in 1995, we discovered that all of the KGB agents were given code names, but my mother was not given a code name. So we had all this material, and it convinced us that we could separate my mother from my father, because the same material showed that while he wasn't engaged in atomic espionage, he was engaged in espionage during World War II, and that so we separated the two cases, and we began to look at my mother's case separately, and we didn't find, we had a lot of evidence that showed that she was framed and that she wasn't guilty, but we didn't have a smoking gun. My brother and I used to joke during the 1970s and 80s, we can't wait to get the FBI file that where J. Edgar Hoover says, nice frame up, guys. But we never got that. However, this last summer, the National Security Agency, after 74 years, released a memo that in which the chief decryptor, the person in charge of the whole project, a legendary figure named Meredith Gardner, concluded just after my mother's arrest that she was not a spy. This is a smoking gun. This is the final piece of the jigsaw puzzle. And that is why we're calling on President Biden, before he leaves office, to exonerate my mother by declaring her conviction and execution wrongful.
Can you talk about the role of Roy Cohen, one of the lawyers who prosecuted your parents, and his side meetings with the judge, Irving Kaufman? Roy Cohen, of course, who, Donald Trump, the president-elect, trained at his knee.
Yes, it's really, here we're asking Biden in some way to, in exonerating my mother, to basically stick a needle in Roy Trump's, in Roy Cohn's eye, because Roy Cohn was one of the engineers of my mother's execution. He was an assistant prosecutor. He was the one who got David and Ruth Greenglass to change their story to implicate my mother. That's one of the amazing things about having all these files. It's not what we claim. It's what the government has. This is not our opinion. And that makes it so much more powerful. So when you put it all together, you mentioned Judge Irving Kaufman. He concluded in sentencing my mother to death that she was, quote, a full-fledged partner in this crime. And now we find out that both the KGB and the NSA didn't consider her a spy, and yet she gets executed as a master atomic spy. So that's why we're asking President Biden to take this action. It is one more indication of what's wrong with the federal death penalty or all death penalty cases. And so that, in doing that, we are asking people to sign a petition. I will give you the website address of that petition. It's a very easy website. It's www.rfc.org/Ethel. You go to that page, you sign the petition, You can also send a very short letter to the U.S. Pardon Agency asking them to basically ask President Biden before he leaves office to declare my mother's execution and conviction wrongful. You could call it a pardon. You could call it an exoneration. It doesn't really matter. The point is, we're doing whatever we can to add pressure to this because we only have like 12 days.
Congressmember Jim McGovern, why have you signed on to this effort? Why do you think it's good for the United States?
Well, I've gotten to know Robert and his family over the years, but I was a history major in college, and quite frankly, I believe that we have to get history right. And as Robert pointed out, the U.S. government knew a week after Ethel's arrest that she was not engaged in espionage, and yet they killed her. It is important that we be voices for truth in this country. And that's why I think this is so incredibly important. You know, we have appealed to President Biden. I, along with a ranking member on intelligence, Jim Himes, you know, supported Robert's attempt to get the NSA document declassified, which I think is a smoking gun. And so it's time for the U.S. government to do the right thing. I know sometimes we look back on history and some of the things our government has done are uncomfortable to reckon with. But you know what? It is important that we get this right. And so I would urge everybody to go to that webpage, to send communications to the White House, to anybody associated with President Biden, and get them to grant Ethel Rosenberg a pardon, an exoneration, or a presidential apology. It is the right thing to do.
I want to thank Robbie Meeropol for joining us, the younger son of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg, joining us from Northampton, Massachusetts. But Congressmember Jim McGovern, a final question. You have a piece in The Guardian headlined, President Biden, Stand Up to the Chevron and Pardon Steve Donziger. You're joining Amnesty International, Greenpeace, and Amazon Watch, and some 50 groups, and urging Biden to pardon the human rights lawyer who was targeted for prosecution by Chevron after he successfully sued the oil giant on behalf of 30,000 Amazonian indigenous in Ecuador, whose land was devastated by oil spills. But instead of paying up for its crimes in the Amazon, Chevron launched a retaliation campaign against Steve Donziger, who spent time in prison and 3 years under house arrest. This is Donziger on Democracy Now!
Chevron committed what is probably the world's worst environmental crime ever by deliberately dumping billions of gallons of toxic oil waste in Ecuador, decimating indigenous groups, causing an outbreak of cancer. And rather than pay for a cleanup, they spent billions of dollars to try to attack the lawyers who have tried to hold them accountable.
So that's Steve Donziger. Democratic Congressmember Jim McGovern, tell us what you're calling for.
I'm calling for a pardon for him as well. Look, I visited Ecuador. I saw what Chevron did. It is disgusting. I mean, you know, we should be ashamed that an American corporation left such a devastating impact in the Amazon region. It is grotesque. And Donziger stood up for these people who had no voice, you know, got a judgment in their favor, and instead of paying up or coming to some sort of settlement, Chevron has spent countless millions and millions of dollars going after Steven Donziger and not helping a single person in Ecuador deal with what they left behind. We have to stand up to corporate excesses in this country. And I think if President Biden would pardon him, I think that would be a signal that maybe things are beginning to change, that maybe we have a system that can stand up to corporate greed and corporate excesses. I should also just add, Amy, that Robert talked about the Rosenberg Foundation. Don Ziger's family, his son, has actually been the beneficiary of some of the support from that foundation. And so they're doing some great things, and I want to thank Robert and his family for all that they do to help people who especially are come under attack by corporations like Chevron.
Yes, the Rosenberg Fund for Children helps children of those who've been incarcerated. Democratic Congressmember Jim McGovern of Massachusetts joining us from the Cannon Rotunda in Washington, D.C. Coming up next, Canadian activist and filmmaker Avi Lewis on the resignation of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Back in 30 seconds.
Garden trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scene of the gallant south.
Billie Holiday singing Lewis Allen's anti-lynching anthem, Strange Fruit. Lewis Allen was the name, the actual name of Abel Meeropol, who's the adopted father of our guest, Robert Meeropol. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. After nearly a decade in power, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced Monday he's stepping down as leader of Canada's Liberal Party. His resignation comes amidst rising discontent over his leadership and growing dissent within his government.
I intend to resign as party leader, as prime minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust nationwide competitive process.
Justin Trudeau has been Canada's prime minister since 2015, but faced plummeting popular support as well as opposition with his own party. His finance minister, Chrystia Freeland, resigned last month amidst a public dispute over how to respond to Trump's vow to impose a 25% tariff on Canadian goods. Freeland is considered one of the possible successors to Trudeau, as is the close ally, Dominic LeBlanc, who was appointed to replace Freeland in December. Canada is scheduled to hold federal elections this year, and polls indicate Canada's Conservatives would win elections if they were held today. The Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, who's been compared to Donald Trump, has pushed anti-labor, anti-regulation measures and called for expanding oil and gas development. At his news conference Tuesday, President-elect Trump, who's repeatedly mocked Canada as America's 51st state, threatened to use economic force to absorb Canada into the United States.
Are you also considering military force to annex and acquire?
No. Economic force. Because Canada and the United States, that would really be something. You get rid of that artificially drawn line and you take a look at what that looks like, and it would also be much better for national security. Don't forget, we basically protect Canada. But here's the problem with Canada. So many friends up there.
Trump continued his push Tuesday evening, posting maps on social media showing Canada as part of the United States, while Trudeau responded saying there isn't a snowball's chance in hell that the two countries will join. For more on Prime Minister Trudeau, Canadian politics, the future of U.S.-Canada relations, we're joined by Avi Lewis, Canadian documentary filmmaker, activist, also candidate in Canada's upcoming federal election, running for the New Democratic Party in Vancouver Center. Thanks so much for joining us, Avi. Can you talk about the significance of what's happening, the resignation of Prime Minister Trudeau, and President Trump threatening to absorb Canada?
Amy, it's great to be back with you. It's been too long. We've had an eventful series of weeks here in Canada. I think as of last weekend, I was the last person in Canada who still thought that Justin Trudeau would run in the next election. He clearly still believes he's the only person who can lead his party, but he's been down 10 or 20% in the polls for a year and a half. He's faced, as you said, an uprising in his own party. And just like Joe Biden, he waited way too long. And his ego got in the way. And now he's finally admitted that he can't do it. And there'll be a chaotic scramble and a leadership race. And I think we'll definitely face an election in the spring. So Canada is in turmoil right at a time when we have a very consequential showdown with your president-elect. And our Pierre Poilievre, our polite Canadian Trump in a t-shirt is way ahead in the polls. And so we're going to have a very intense and very important debate in Canada about integration with the United States. Well, I mean, the irony here, Amy, as you know and have covered for decades, is that the whole point of Canadian American so-called free trade, the Canada-US free trade deal first in 1988 and then NAFTA and following deals, have been to integrate our economies, to give the United States unfettered access, particularly to our oil. And we're by the free trade, so-called free trade treaties, we're not allowed to reduce oil exports to the United States by any significant way. Obviously a problem in a time of climate emergency, but there's already immense integration between our economies. And obviously these tariffs that Trump has been threatening would be absolutely brutal for working families on both sides of the border, and would reignite the inflation crisis and the cost of living crisis. So that's the political debate we're having now. As far as Trump, you know, threatening the usual stuff, you know, it's a little bit of a balancing act. We have to take it seriously, but we can't overreact. That's what a bully wants, to send people running in fear. We don't take the bait here. And I'm proud that the New Democratic Party leader, Jagmeet Singh, is the only Canadian political leader who's talking about retaliatory tariffs in response to this latest cartoon threat, which is how it will have to play out. But we should look at how this fits into a pattern with Trump. He's a grabber. He wants to grab Panama. He wants to grab Greenland. He grabs women. For him, the whole point of power is to use it. Using force as an expression of his own power is the way he's conducted his personal life, is the way he's conducted his business life. And now he doesn't understand why he can't use the US military and the US economy the same way. So it is a real threat, and Canadians should get mobilized to fight it, especially to protect our water, because he talked in the fall about turning on this huge faucet and having access to Canada's water, and to get back to the free trade agenda that Conservatives and Liberals have implemented to the immense harm of working people in Canada over the last decades. It was always about water, and both Conservatives and Liberals in Canada were prepared to put water on the table, and only the New Democratic Party and social movements, incredible civil society organizations, have risen again and again to stop the sale of our water.
Would you say if there were an election held today that the Conservatives would win, but because of what Trump is saying right now, you know, talking about absorbing Canada and not relenting on this, that could put the Conservatives at a disadvantage?
I mean, I certainly hope so. They're way up in the polls, but it's an incredibly volatile time in Canada. And, you know, honestly, Amy, that's why I'm stepping up and running for office right now, which is not, you know, it's not an easy thing to do. It's filled with contradictions. But, you know, I think my grandpa said it best. My grandfather, David Lewis, was leader of the federal NDP in the early 70s. And the early 70s were a time much like this. An inflation-driven cost of living crisis. Just like today, the right was blaming immigrants and poor folks, people without work or housing who were living on the street, saying it was the welfare bums to blame for our problems. And my grandpa David Lewis said, you know who's to blame? The corporate welfare bums. He said, big business and government are holding hands in your pocket. And we're very much in the same place today. Like every sector of the economy is dominated by a handful of huge corporations led by billionaire CEOs, and they are shoveling the people's wealth into their own pockets as fast as their soft lily-white hands can move. In Canada, we got five big banks making extraterrestrial profits, whether the interest rates are up or down. We got five big oil companies who have captured government. They were gifted a $34 billion pipeline that the people paid for, while big oil has used its influence and capture of government to block any meaningful climate action. We got three big telecom corporations, which is why we have the most expensive and crappiest cell phone service and data service in the world. We got three big supermarket chains, plus Walmart and Costco, who are price fixing, colluding to keep charging $10 for butter, even though inflation is down. In the States, you've just had Potato Gate, where the two big potato companies are the subject of a class action lawsuit for fixing the price of tater tots. Like, Amy, is nothing sacred in this time of corporate welfare bums. And then there are more and more people who are working for big tech platforms in the gig economy that have turned us, our lives, our intimate lives, and the value we create into a commodity that their algorithms mine for profits, like the big real estate companies use algorithms to jack up the rent, which in a city like Vancouver is just too damn high. So you got an Uber driver working 12 or 14 hours in their own car at their own expense, just working for the app on their phone and the big tech bro behind it to steal more than half the value they're creating. So the right wing is right. There is a small elite that's responsible for the fact that you work and work and work and still can't afford a decent home, nice food, and a vacation once in a while. But it's them. In Canada, the Conservative Party is the party of billionaires, the ultra rich, the corporate welfare bums. But it doesn't have to be this way. And that's the beautiful thing about elections. And as we head into this next chaotic period in Canada, it's important to remember elections are a time when the people have the power to decide, when we get to throw the corporate welfare bums out. Before but what we vote for, yeah, go ahead, Amy.
Before we end, I wanted to ask you about Jimmy Carter. His state funeral is taking place in National Cathedral in Washington Thursday, which President Biden has declared National Day of Mourning. He died December 29th at the age of 100. When he was inaugurated in 1977, Carter fulfilled a campaign promise to pardon those who resisted the Vietnam War draft. He issued Proclamation 4483 on his first full day in office. Avi Lewis, many American war resistors fled to Canada, your homeland, among them your father-in-law, Naomi Klein's father. During an interview in 1999, Carter reflected on his decision to pardon Vietnam draft resistors, many of them conscientious objectors.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it was it has been a moving moment in Canada. Obviously, lots of bad things happen under any American president. And we've had a healthy debate about, you know, things that the American Empire did under Jimmy Carter that were not to be celebrated. But, actually turning down the thermostat and putting solar panels on the White House and saying, hey, if it's cold, put on a sweater. Common sense forecasting of the climate emergency to come. And the energy emergencies that have been serial in the period of climate breakdown and fossil fuel dominance, that was really memorable. His pardoning of the war resistors of Vietnam, I mean, that was a generation of 35,000 idealistic young people. There were doctors, there were professionals, and others like Naomi's dad who came and helped us build our single-payer universal healthcare system. And that's, you know, talking about Trudeau now, part of his legacy is that since the pandemic, the privatization of healthcare in Canada has been absolutely terrifying. You can now pay $150 to get on the phone with a doctor in Canada. And that's what the draft dodger generation, the 70s generation, that nostalgia that we have for Carter, that was when we really built up our public healthcare system. And we have to fight now the corporate welfare bums and the rising right to rescue that vision of taxing the super rich and using that money to build back our universal public services so that people can go to the doctor and to complete the dream of Tommy Douglas's dream of Canadian healthcare, our grandfather, our socialist grandfather of universal Medicare, to include eyes and teeth and mental health and medicine.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Of course, Tommy Douglas, the grandfather of the actor Kiefer Sutherland. Avi Lewis, Canadian documentary filmmaker and activist, also candidate in Canada's upcoming federal election, running for the New Democratic Party, the NDP, in Vancouver Centre. Up next, the Pentagon's released 11 men from Guantanamo. They're from Yemen to Oman. We'll speak with two lawyers involved with their cases. Back in 20 seconds.
And someday we'll make this world a little brighter. The
Deep Water by Ed Askew, the singer-songwriter, passed away Saturday at the age of 84. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. After more than 20 years of being in prison without charge or trial at Guantanamo Bay, the Pentagon's transferred 11 Yemeni men to Oman to restart their lives. These men had been approved for transfer for years, but remained behind bars because of political or diplomatic obstacles. Before arriving at Guantanamo, four of the men transferred to Oman on Monday had been held at secret overseas CIA prisons known as black sites, where torture was common. In recent weeks, the U.S. has transferred four other Guantanamo prisoners. This latest push at the end of the Biden administration brings the total number of men detained at Guantanamo down to 15, the fewest since the George W. Bush administration turned Guantanamo into a military prison for mostly Muslim men taken into custody around the world during the so-called War on Terror. A total of 780 men have been detained at Guantanamo since 2002. Rights groups are calling on the Biden administration to resettle Guantanamo's last 15 prisoners and close the notorious prison once and for all. Six of those remaining have never been charged with a crime. Three have already been cleared for transfer by the Biden administration. The government spends $500 million a year keeping the prison and the court at Guantanamo open for this small number of men. For more on this story, we're joined here in New York by two guests. Ramzi Kassam is with us, professor of law at CUNY, City University of New York, representing Guantanamo prisoners Moad al-Alwi and Sanad al-Kazimi, who've just been released and flown to Oman. Pardis Kabriai is senior staff attorney with Center for Constitutional Rights. Her last client, Sharkawi Al-Haj, was among the 11 Yemeni prisoners just transferred. We welcome you both back to Democracy Now! Pardis, let's begin with you. The significance of this move by President Biden.
You know, Amy, we'll start with the men and their families. 23 years they've been in prison in the most extreme deprivation. It's prison. Guantanamo is prison, and it's then some. For 23 years. So the release of these people and their freedom for the first time after all of this time, the chance to reunify with their families and begin to recover and rebuild is, you know, it's hard to overstate the enormity of that.
Tell
for
us
them.
About Sharkawi.
Sharkawi is 51. He's been inside since, I think he was captured when he was 28, 29. Abroad in Pakistan. He, you know, it's been 23 years in Guantanamo. He's gone through his entire 30s and 40s there. He's lost both of his parents in prison. He is among the men you mentioned who was held in CIA sites before he was brought to Guantanamo in 2004. He was held in those sites for over 2 years and experienced.
What was he charged with?
Nothing. Nothing. He wasn't charged with anything. None of the men. The vast majority, most of the men at Guantanamo have never been charged with anything. There are nine people in the system now who have been charged or convicted.
And explain why Guantanamo exists, precisely for that reason, right? So you can engage in extrajudicial, explain what extrajudicial laws are, that you can be held for 23 years and never charged.
I mean, Guantanamo was set up as a place it was an intelligence gathering operation. The point of it was to establish a place offshore where people could be held outside the bounds of the law without access to courts, incommunicado, and where they could be interrogated. It was an intelligence gathering operation from the beginning. It's why the site was chosen, and they were held without charge, without access to lawyers or courts for 2 years into their detention. The treatment they suffered was largely for the purpose of breaking them down. I mean, Guantanamo has such a long history that we've forgotten. It's been documented in scores. But the things that these people have been through, and Sharkawi, you know, speak on his behalf in CIA sites, is the worst of what we do. So in terms of the significance, you know, it is the end of that acuteness, the acuteness of that, and a chance to, you know.
Will they be imprisoned in Oman, or will they be free?
They will not. They will not. They have landed as free people. Oman has taken people in before. There are over about 30 people who were taken in 2015 to 2017. Oman provided them support and rehabilitation. It's been a relatively good resettlement. There are questions about the group that was, the Yemenis who were sent there before were sent back against their will, in some cases, to Yemen after years of being in Oman, and there is a question about that. And it's important to say that by deciding to take these men in, Oman has an obligation of protection and support.
Let me ask Ramzi Kassin about the two men that you represented, and that you in the last 2 years have served as senior policy advisor at the White House, and also with your students have represented 15 prisoners at Guantanamo, at Bagram Air Base, other secret or U.S. Disclosed U.S. facilities worldwide. Tell us about the two men.
Maaz al-Alwi is also a Yemeni national. He's one of the very first prisoners who arrived at Guantanamo almost. I mean, the prison was opened on January 11th, 2002. He was on the second or the third plane. You could tell by his low internment serial number, 028. He was never charged with any crime. He was, like the majority of prisoners at Guantanamo, sold for a bounty, $5,000 to $15,000 that the U.S. government was paying to tribes in the Afghanistan-Pakistan border region for so-called Arabs out of place. And, you know, by the government's own allegations, Mr. al-Alwi never so much as fired a shot at U.S. forces or their allies. Still, he spent 23 years, over half of his life, at Guantanamo. He became an accomplished artist at that time. Sanad al-Kazemi, like Pardis's client, Sanad al-Kazemi survived the CIA black sites. He was disappeared in the United Arab Emirates, survived severe forms of physical and psychological torture at a prison that the prisoners who survived it called the Prison of Darkness, or the Dark Prison. The CIA called it the Salt Pit, or Cobalt, in the Senate's report about the torture that happened there. And he was brought to Guantanamo in 2004. He was also never charged with a crime. He has four kids that he hasn't seen for, you know, the better part of their lives. And, you know, he was looking forward to, as much as possible, try to rebuild and try to reintegrate these roles as a father.
Tell me about the art that al-Alwi, I mean, he's a real, I mean, the level of artistry here. What was Trump's response when the New York Times did a profile of him as an artist?
Yeah, the Trump administration at the time and the Department of Defense. Export their art from the island prison to the outside world. All of that because there was a show displaying the art, not just of Mr. al-Alwi, but many of the other prisoners at John Jay College, which is part of the City University of New York. And so the Department of Defense decided to impose a ban on Guantanamo art, declaring that the art was literally the property of the U.S. government. We had officials threaten some of our clients that their art would be seized and destroyed. Now, thankfully, you know, our understanding is that Mr. al-Alwi was able to take much of his art with him to Oman, and he looks forward to continuing with that skill set to express himself.
We just have about a minute. What does Biden need to do? He has, what, just over a week left?
Guantanamo has always been a question of political will. Biden actually has an opportunity to do more than he has already done. Perhaps the single most remarkable thing about the transfer of the 11 prisoners this week is that there has been complete silence from the Republican camp. And that's because Guantanamo is no longer as politically valuable as it once was. The Republican, and this may be the depressing way of looking at it, the Republicans have so thoroughly won on every front, including with the last election, that they no longer need to beat up the Democrats over Guantanamo. And in that lies an opportunity for President Biden.
And even with DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency, the $500 million spent on a prison for what, it's now 15 men, Pardis? Your final comment.
And concretely, there are 6 of the 15 men have never been charged, will never be charged. 3 of those men have been cleared for transfer and are awaiting transfer. Those men should be transferred at a minimum, and that includes a CCR client who remains, Guli Duran Hassan from Somalia. At a minimum, this DOJ should drop its opposition to their habeas cases, to the habeas cases of anyone who will remain.
For the prison to be closed?
We are calling for the end of the system of indefinite detention to close, and they are very close to doing that. That can be done.
We're going to leave it there. Pardis Kabriai is a senior staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Attorney Ramzi Qasem is a professor.